Okay, good morning, everybody. Nice to see everybody here today. Ner Shlishi Lechanukah, the third day of Hanukkah, 1st of December, first winter day in Jerusalem. Today, we're reminded that actually winter has started. Does everybody have a sheet here, please? Everybody should have the sheet. Today, we're dealing with Hanukkah. And as you can see, the topic today is two views on the Hasmonean dynasty, Malchut Chashmonaim. There was a dynasty of kings that was initiated and founded at the Hanukkah story. And the question is, how did we view that new dynasty of kings? Lasted just over 100 years and was an integral part of Hanukkah events. Let's just zoom out for a minute and speak about Hanukkah for a couple of minutes, just to get us into to focus on the issues we're going to be looking at today. So it's important to understand that it's always interesting, I think, to contrast Hanukkah and Purim. Hanukkah and Purim are the two rabbinic Yomim Tovim of our calendar, right? Those are the two days of the year that don't come from the Chumash, but come from the Chachomim, which were initiated by the Chachmei HaMishnah, right, which have their source in the views of Chazal. One of the interesting contrasts is to understand that Purim was a physical threat to Klal Yisrael, that Haman wanted lahashmid, laharog, ulaabed, and kol ha'yudim. He wanted massacre. Right? What he wanted, what he planned, was a Holocaust. He didn't care whether you were keeping mitzvahs or not keeping mitzvahs, whether you were learning Torah or not learning Torah, whether you believed in God or not believed in God. He was an absolute fascist, right? He was interested in one thing only, lahashmid, laharog, or la'abed. That is a type of enemy, sadly, that the Jewish history we have known, right? The Nazis and the Holocaust, they weren't concerned whether you were from or not from, whether you're doing mitzvahs or not doing mitzvahs, made no difference. If you were part of the Jewish race, then you were to be obliterated in the final solution. That was Haman. And what we're celebrating at Purim is that throughout Jewish history, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has protected us from the Hamans of this world. It's vital when we're celebrating Hanukkah to understand that Hanukkah, the Jewish people, were not under a physical threat. The Yevonim, the Greeks, the Hellenists, did not hate the Jews. They did not want to kill the Jews, right? They were not barbarians, the Hellenists in the Hanukkah story. And in actual fact, the threat to the Jewish people was not a physical threat. It was a spiritual, cultural threat, right? As we say in the Al-Hanisim, that the goal of the Yevonim wasn't, as I said with Purim, lahashmid la'argo la'abed. The goal was lahashkichom teirosecho or lahavirom mechukei ritzoinecho. That's the quote from Al-Hanisim. They wanted lahashkichom, they want you to forget Torah. Forget it. We are the modern Hellenist culture. Your Torah is ancient and obsolete. We are offering you modernity in the shape of Hellenist beliefs and Hellenist culture. And they wanted us to forget about Judaism. So there is a very clear contrast between Hanukkah and Purim, the physical survival we are celebrating in Purim, and the spiritual survival we are celebrating at Hanukkah. However, what's interesting, and it's interesting to note when we read the story of Purim, of Hanukkah, when we read the story of Hanukkah, we are really, the literature of Hanukkah and the Simcha of Hanukkah focuses on two very different miraculous events. The one that we all know about from Cheder, the one that we learn about as a kid, was the little jug of oil that lasted for 8 days, even though it only had in it enough oil for one day. And that was a tremendous, if you like, sign of a supernatural protection from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a sign of a nace. But the truth is that the real miracle of Hanukkah was the military victory. The real miracle was the fact that the Jewish people, the Hashmonaim, Yehuda Maccabee and his team of rebels were outnumbered and outgunned enormously by the Greek Seleucids, by the power of Antiochus the Fourth, who wanted to completely obliterate the Jews. Funnily enough, if you read Hellenist literature, the Hellenists, they loved the Jews. Why did they love the Jews? Because the Jews made actually very good Hellenists. In other words, once the Jews convert, once they assimilated, those Jews that assimilated into Hellenist culture became tremendously dedicated to the art and the philosophy and the culture, and the whole mindset of Hellenism was something that assimilated Jews swallowed up very enthusiastically. Yes, just a short reminder, even though I'm not wearing a mask, so I'm a bad example here, I'm afraid, but I'm exempted. I'm only exempted while I'm sitting here, incidentally. If I walk in without a mask, I'm in trouble. But while I'm sitting here, I have a special pass, a special exemption. Otherwise, you won't understand what I'm saying. But the Hellenists wanted to impose Hellenism on Judea, on Israel, and on the Jewish people, and the miracle of Hanukkah was that Klal Yisrael was saved from spiritual disaster. Purim, we were saved from a physical disaster, and Hanukkah, we were saved from a spiritual disaster. But the battle was a real battle. The battle was a military battle. Yehuda Maccabee and the Yochanan ben Matisyahu Kohen Gadol and his sons. The battle was fought, and the enemy was defeated. What's interesting, though, is to understand the context, and that's important for our share today, that these events take place approximately in the year 167 BCE. So 167 BCE, right, approximately 2300 years ago, 2400 years ago, and that is, in terms of Jewish history, it's in the middle of what's called the Bayit Sheni period, the Second Temple period. So the Jewish people, just to give you a big picture here, the Jewish people have returned to Israel under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, and with the Nevi'im, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, they were led back to the land of Israel to rebuild the temple, what's called the Bayit Sheni, the Second Temple. And that had happened 200 years earlier, but they were living in Israel under foreign rule. It's true they had physically returned to Israel, but they were under Persian rule, right? The Persian Empire, they were parts of the Persian Empire. And then when Alexander the Great, the Greeks defeated the Persians, they were under Greek rule. So they were living a full Jewish life in the land of Israel, but, and here comes the important point, which is crucial for this Shia, is what they didn't have was Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. They were living a fully Jewish life with a Beit HaMikdash, with Kohanim and Levim and Karbanot and everything, right? But they didn't have Jewish sovereignty. They didn't have a Jewish king. They were under the umbrella of first the Persian Empire and then the Greek Empire. And both the Persian and the Greek Empire seem to have been very tolerant of Jews living as Jews. They didn't mind. Everybody could live according to their own beliefs and religion until Antiochus the Fourth turns up. And Antiochus the Fourth is the villain of this story. And he seems to have been an absolute egomaniac. Very interesting stories about Antiochus the Fourth. He called himself Epiphanes, which means really God made incarnate. In other words, he believed that he was God incarnate. It was not unusual for kings throughout history. They believed that they were personally elected by God, but he felt that he was God himself. He stopped the, if you like, live and let live policy of Alexander the Great, and he wanted to impose Hellenism with the sword on all his subjects, including the Jews in Judea, in Israel at the time. And hence we have the battle and the miraculous victory. So here we've got two things. We've got the miracle of the little jug of oil, and then we've got the miracle of the military victory, which then gets rid of the Greeks. And what are we able to do at Hanukkah? We're able to reestablish Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. For the first time since the Churban Bayit Rishon, since the destruction of the first temple, we were able to establish Jewish kings, and these were the Hashmonaim. The Hasmonean dynasty were established at that period. In the sheets in front of you, incidentally, if you flick to the back, to the page 4, which is the back, the last page, you've got a little bit of a flowchart of the Hasmonean dynasty. Can you see that? Where there's Mattathias, the Mattathiahu, right? Mattathiahu ben Yochanan Cohen. So he's got his 5 sons, right? Of which Shimon was the high priest. Can you see that? And Yehuda Maccabee was also a high priest. And Eliezer and Yonason, these were his 5 sons. And they really led the revolt. And then in the next generation already, there was again a Yehuda and a Mattathiahu and Yochanan Hyrcanus the first. They were already kings. They were already sat on the throne in Israel and made themselves a king of Israel. And this continued into the third line, which is Aristobulus and Yanai, Alexander Yanai, and Antigonus, these were, and then his sons, Hyrcanus, Aristobulus. This was a series which ends with Herod. Can you see it? The last line is Herod. Herod becomes king. He marries a girl from the Hasmonean royal dynasty. Incidentally, in all this, there is the first and only queen that Israel ever had. Israel never had a queen. Right, because in the halacha of Soim Tosim Olecho Melech, when kings were chosen by prophecy or nevuah, it was always a man. But here in the middle of the Hasmonean dynasty, there's an interesting mini story here. Does anybody know who the queen was? Shlomtzion Hamalka. Shlomtzion Hamalka was the wife of King Yanai. And so when Yanai dies, she takes over. Instead of her son taking over, she takes over, Shlomtzion Hamalka. And incidentally, from a Torah point of view, from the point of view of having somebody in power who was halachically observant and sympathetic to Emunah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, she was the best of all of these. She was much better than her husband and all the other kings. She was actually the sister of Shimon ben Shetach, who was the Rosh Bezdin at the time. The head of the Bezdin at the time, in the middle of this, is Shimon ben Shetach, who appears incidentally on today's daf, Shimon ben Shetach. But sure, he was a famous Tana, one of the early Tanaim. This is a period of the Mishnah, incidentally, historically, a period of the Mishnah. And Shlomtzion Hamalka is, in a sense, something of a heroine in the middle of all this story, but that's maybe a subject for a separate share, which I won't go into for the moment. And as you get an idea that there was a whole new royal dynasty that was created. And what did they do? They restored Jewish sovereignty to the land of Israel. Okay, sadly, I think one has to say here, most of these people on this list of kings actually abandoned Judaism. One of the ironies of the Hanukkah story is that even though the battle against the Greeks was fought in order to get rid of Hellenism and allow the Jews to practice mitzvahs and live as fully as Jews in Israel, the irony is that these kings, once they become powerful and wealthy, they become Hellenized. And they actually abandon Torah and mitzvahs, and they themselves assimilate. It's a very sad story, actually, that the Hasmonean dynasty, from a Torah point of view, was not a great achievement, right? And we'll come back to that, please God, a bit later on in the Shia. Okay, this is really, I've given you, so far, I've just been speaking in terms of big picture background, what we're going to look at. What I'd like to look at now is a pasuk in Parshas Vayechi, and a very important comment made by one of the most prominent commentaries on the Chumash, the Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, in the 13th century. Let's have a look what he's saying here. Everybody with me on the page number one? The Pasuk says, Lo yosur shevet mi Yehuda, u'mechokek mi bein raglov, ad ki yovoy shiloi, v'lo yikhas amim. Okay, this is part of Vayechi, where Yaakov Avinu on his deathbed is giving personalized blessings and instructions and warnings to all his 12 sons. And each one gets a different message, okay? Yehuda gets the message that he is going to be the Melech. Gur Aryeh Yehuda, he is going to be the Melech. He's going to be the source of Malchus. And of course, eventually, David HaMelech comes from Yehuda. But what does the Pasuk here say? Let's look at these words a bit more carefully now. Lo yosur shevet mi Yehuda. The shevet means the scepter, meaning the status of a ruler, of kingship, should not be removed from Yehuda. Right? U'mechokek mibein raglav. The mechokek is the lawgiver, right? The institute in each culture. There is an institution that makes the laws, that decides on the laws. He was also the mechokek, the lawgiver. So the Pasuk is saying here that Yehuda is given exclusive rights to kingship in Israel. Okay. The Ramban is concerned about this on various different levels because, of course, in Jewish history, there were people who became king who weren't from Yehuda. I won't go into the whole issue here. It's actually quite interesting. So he's, for example, interested in the first king of Israel, who was Shaul HaMelech, who came from the tribe of Binyamin. So why was Shaul chosen from Binyamin if the Pasuk here tells us that kings have to come from Yehuda? That's a question I'm just putting out there or leaving that for the time being. Later on also, we find that after King David and King Solomon, who were indeed from Yehuda, are no longer alive, in the next generation, the whole of Israel is split between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, right? And Yerovam, who has the northern kingdom, is also not from Yehuda. So how does this work? How is it possible there are other kings? This is what the Ramban deals with. And in that context, he says the following. Okay, I haven't translated the next bit, so you'll have to read with me as we go along. Can you see where it says Ramban commentary? Ulefi dati. Can you see that? Where he says, Ulefi dati, and my view is. And incidentally, when the Rishonim use this phrase, lefi da'ati, what they're really saying is, I don't have an absolute source for this. This is my judgment. This is my evaluation. I can't prove it from a text, right? But it is my understanding of what this pasuk means. He says, lefi da'ati, and my view is, hoyu hamalochim hamolchim al Yisrael mishar ashvatim achrei David, those kings who took office over the Jewish people after David HaMelech, they were Ovrim al Da'as Avihem. They were transgressing the instructions of the Zeda. Who was the Zeda? Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu gave instructions, this is how I want my descendants to be, to live in future generations. And one of them was that the Melech is Yehuda. He says, and he uses another very interesting word here in the second line of the Ramban, Uma'avirim Nachalo. Ma'avirim Nachalo is quite an interesting halachic terminology of, in terms of inheritance, that somebody is taking part of an estate which he's not entitled to. Ma'avirim Nachalo means they are stealing the Nachalo of Yehuda. The Nachalo of Yehuda, his inheritance is to be the king, and if anybody who takes that away from him is in violation of Yaakov Avinu's stated desire for Yehuda to be the king. Fine. And then he says in the second line, "Behemo Yosomchem b'Devar Achri Hashiloni." Okay, that's a reference to Yerovam and Rehovam. I won't go into that for the moment. Let's have a look at the second paragraph of the Ramban's commentary. Can you see? Which starts with the word v'zeh. V'zeh hoya onesh ha-chashmonayim. The Ramban now is very critical of the chashmonayim. And this is a bit rare. Most of you have heard the story of Bimei Matisyahu ben Yochanan, Kain Godel, and Yehuda Maccabee. You haven't heard much criticism ever of what they did. They were the heroes. Yehuda Maccabee was the hero. Matisyahu ben Yochanan was the hero. They did fantastic things. They took up arms. They defended Klal Yisrael. Says the Ramban, they did one thing wrong. The punishment of the Chashmonaim, Shemolchu b'bayis sheni, that they took the Malchus, they took the kingdom on themselves in the Second Temple period. And look at his, the next phrase here is very, very interesting in the Ramban. Ki hoyu chasidei elio, they were great tzaddikim. He says, I'm not saying that the Chashmonaim were bad people. They were spiritually tremendously, of a tremendously high status, chasidei elio. Very interesting language of the Ramban. The ilmolei haim, and if it wasn't for them, nishtakchu ha-Torah v'amitzvos Yisrael. The whole of Torah could have been forgotten in Klal Yisrael. Had the Hellenists been successful, they would have persecuted the Jewish people to such a degree that there would never have been a Mishnah, there would never have been a Gemara, and the whole of Torah Shebaal Peh would be lost, and Yiddishkeit would be lost. So he's saying they have a tremendous credit to their name, the Chashmonaim. Interesting language, this. In the Shtakhu HaTorah B'Mitzvah Yisrael. In other words, the whole of Torah was on the verge of being forgotten in Klal Yisrael. It's important to remember, incidentally, that of course, Torah Shebaal Peh, our whole Judaism, our entire practice, whatever you and I call Judaism, whether it's Shabbos or Bris Milah or Pesach or Yom Kippur, whatever it is, is dependent on our reading of Torah Shebaal Peh. In the Torah Shebichtav, if we only had the Chumash and didn't have the Mishnah and the Gemara, we wouldn't know how to practice Judaism. We wouldn't know how to keep Shabbos, we wouldn't know how to do Bris Milah, we wouldn't know how to build a sukkah, we wouldn't know how to do anything. It's only Torah Shebaal Peh which gives us this information. Now, it's interesting, of course, that at this period of the Hanukkah story, nothing of Torah Shebaal Peh had yet been written down. It was all still Baal Peh. Baal Peh means it existed only in the minds of the Talmidei Chachamim of each generation who transmitted it into the minds of the next generation. But it was never written down. We can't even imagine something like that. That's the truth. It's hard for us to imagine this, that this massive body of knowledge, right? All the details of all the halachas, of brachas, and of tefillah, and of Shabbos, and of kashrus, and of everything, is all just only exists in people's minds because they'd learnt it ba'al peh from their teachers, and nothing was written yet. Right? And that, of course, made it very very fragile. In other words, if key individuals would have been killed, then it would have been lost completely because there was no record of it anyway. It was only later on, right? Maybe 400 years later on, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi decides that's it. It's too dangerous that Torah Shebaal Peh should remain Baal Peh. We have to write down the Mishnah. But at this period, it only exists in people's minds. So that's what Ramban here means, is that we were in danger of losing the whole Torah because those key individuals could have been killed. But I'm still in the middle of the second paragraph here of the Ramban. For Afal Pikein, Nen Shu Onish Gadol. But look at what happened to the Chashmonaim. They were punished, a very severe punishment. Ki Arba Bnei HaChashmonaim HaZokim HaChasidim HaMolchim Zeh HaChazeh. All the four sons of Matisyahu Ben Yochanan, who became kings one after another, im kol gvurosam vatzlachosam, despite all their great prowess and military powers, noflu biyad oivehim becherib, they were all killed in battle. And what he's saying, we see that actually, we know the story. The story was that they fought bravely, but they were all killed in battle. And says that, okay, that can happen in battle. But the Ramban says this was not just by chance. And this is the lafi da'ati of the Ramban. Rabbi said, let me tell you what really went wrong in the Hanukkah story. So look at the last paragraph here. The Efsha Gamkein Shehoyo Aleim Chait B'Malchusom, taking the Malchus was an Avera. Mipnei Shehoyu Kohanim. They were Kohanim, right? And here's an interesting thing. We, just as an aside here, in terms of political theory, we're all familiar that in the Western world, democratic states are very particular between what is called in the non-Jewish world, separation of church and state, right? Which means that the religious authorities shouldn't also be the political authorities. right? And that political and legal authorities are not allowed to legislate religious ideas, right? That's built into the American Constitution, that's built into the British legal system, to separate church and state. And people are sometimes under the idea that this was invented somehow by modern democratic political theory. In actual fact, Yaakov Avinu in Parshas Vayechi says very clearly that I want the children of Levi to be the religious authorities, and they shouldn't fight in the battles, and they shouldn't own property, and they shouldn't become wealthy. They have to be Kohanim and Levim. And then you have to have Yehuda, who becomes the Melech, and they have to be different, they have to keep separate. That the Malchus and the religious authorities shouldn't be the same people. Okay. There was a whole series of battles. We speak about, there wasn't like one battle. It went on for a couple of years, the whole story, and eventually they were killed. The truth is, there is some confusion about this. The exact details, historic, we have in Josephus, we have a fair amount of detail of these battles, and we also have what's called the Book of Maccabees. Most of the historical information we get from a book called the Book of Maccabees, which isn't part of the Tanakh, so it's not Kitvei Kodesh. The Sefer Maccabim is not Kitvei Kodesh, but it is historically valid. The Sefer Maccabim is a very interesting, is the earliest and probably most accurate account of the whole Hanukkah story that we have. Okay, so what I'm saying is that's not clear. Historically speaking, it's not clear. It could be that they became king. First one became king, and then he was killed in battle. The next one became king, and then he was killed in battle. That's what the Ramban is assuming here. I'm not getting into the historical scholarship of this at the moment. So we were in Babylonia. The Jewish people were exiled to Babylonia after the destruction of the first temple, right? But after a relatively short time, 70 years roughly, they started, Ezra and Nehemiah, take them back to Israel to rebuild the second temple, okay? And they succeed in rebuilding the second temple under the Persian government. They got planning permission, zoning permission from the Persian government. From Cyrus, that's right. So much so that actually one of the gates of the second temple was called Sha'ar Shushan, was the gate of Shushan HaBira, and there was on it an artistic sort of relief of the city of Shushan in gratitude to Cyrus and the Persian Empire for giving them permission, right, by kind permission of the Persian government, who were tolerant and allowed Jewish people to serve God and to keep mitzvahs and to be Jewish. And when Alexander took over, he was Alexander the Great, he continued that tradition of tolerance. It's only when the Greek Syrians, Antiochus Epiphanes, came into power, he became intolerant, and he started to persecute the Jewish people. That was the sequence of events. What the Ramban here is saying is, let me just summarize the Ramban for 1 minute, because it's a very important point. He's saying that Chashmonaim were our heroes, and we celebrate Hanukkah because of them. And they did the most amazing job in getting rid of the Hellenists, but they made a mistake. They made a mistake. They took on themselves the Malchut. They became kings. What they should have done, according to the Ramban, he hasn't said this, but I'm paraphrasing, what they should have done was saying, right, we've now got rid of the Yevonim, the Hellenists. We now are able to live a full sovereign Jewish life. Let us now take somebody from the tribe of Yehuda. Let's find somebody, an appropriate representative of the genealogy of Yehuda, who are the rightful kings of Israel, and let's reestablish a kingdom in Israel based on Yehuda. That's what they should have done. Instead of which, they took it for themselves, says the Rambam. That was a massive error for which they paid a terrible price. Yes, David. I don't know. It's much, much more than terminology. They really called themselves kings. They ran a kingdom. Yanai HaMelech. They wore a crown. They considered themselves definitely to be Malchei Yisrael. In the whole list of kings of Israel, there is like 100 plus years of Malchei Yisrael, who are Chashmonaim, who are Kohanim. So the Ramban says there are two problems here. One problem is they should have given it over to the Yehuda, And the other problem is, as Kohanim, it was particularly problematic for them. Let's say if they would have come from the tribe of Reuven or Dan, it would also have been a problem, but not so much of a problem. But here they've got a double problem. First of all, they're not Yehuda. Secondly, they are Kohanim. So them taking the Malchus was a major, major error, and for which they paid a heavy price. And the Ramban is very angry with them about this. And he says that's an important issue to understand in the story of Hanukkah. Let me just add, interestingly, introduce maybe an idea which has been written about. Following the Ramban, it could be that we get a little bit of a deeper insight into the Hanukkah that we celebrate. Because part of the questions that are raised about Hanukkah is, why was it that Chazal really took, if you like, all the events surrounding the Hanukkah story, and they shifted the focus completely away from the military victory onto the little jug of oil? The little jug of oil, in reality, the Maharal of Prague, for example, writes about this in a couple of places. He wrote a whole book, incidentally, called Ner Mitzvah. The Maharal wrote a book called Ner Mitzvah, dedicated completely to Hanukkah. And in it, one of the points he makes is, he says, it's not possible that a Yontif was made because of the little jug of oil. The little jug of oil was, in a certain sense, says the Maharal, trivial. It was trivial. The little jug of oil lasted for 8 days. What would have been had it not lasted for 8 days? Wouldn't have been terrible. So they would have had to wait for another 8 days until they lit the menorah. So why would that would have been such a... They hadn't had the menorah for a couple of years under the persecution of the Hellenists. So they would have had another wait another 8 days. So what? Now, it's true, it was miraculous, and it's true, it lasted for 8 days, but for that to make a yontif, the Maharal's not convinced, right? So he says, no, the real yontif of Hanukkah is that Yehuda Maccabi succeeded militarily in getting rid of the enemy and reestablishing Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel and allowing the Jews to live as Jews in the land of Israel. That was the nace. That was miraculous. Right? Similar in a certain sense, I just want to say to you, in terms of modern Medinat Yisrael, right? The Yom, of all the Yomim Tovim in the calendar, right? On the Jewish calendar, the one which is most similar to the modern reestablishment of Medinat Yisrael is Hanukkah, right? The battle fought in the land of Israel to get rid of the enemies of Israel and reestablish Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, that's the story of Medinat Yisrael, right? So Hanukkah is the closest of all the Yomim Tovim to really the story that we have today that we are celebrating. So why are we not celebrating? We should be more focused on the Hashmonaim and Yehuda Maccabi as great military leaders, political leaders, and the establishment of Jewish sovereignty. Why is that not center stage? In a sense, the Chachamim have succeeded in shifting our focus away onto the little jug of oil. And one of the answers could be this Ramban. Because the Ramban is saying that actually the political military side of the Hanukkah story was very problematic. It was a great relief to get rid of the enemy, but the way it was done and the people who did it and the outcome of it to establish a Malchus of Kohanim, that was very problematic. And therefore the Hanukkah focuses us on the jug of oil and doesn't focus us on the military and political achievements of that time, which were massive and which were miraculous, right? So this is an interesting insight into Hanukkah for us today. I'm afraid the rain is so hard here on this window next to me that I can't, you have to speak a little bit louder. Now, I'm accustomed to this from London, I'm accustomed to, but here in Israel, I'm not so used to having such a crashing sound of rain right next to me. Okay. What I'd like to show you, though, is on a close reading of the Rambam of Maimonides, right? It seems that Maimonides was not in agreement with the Rambam, or at least not completely in agreement with the Rambam. So let's have a look. Let's learn together now a little bit of Rambam at the bottom of page 1. If you can't manage the Hebrew, it's translated on page 2. I'll go through the Hebrew with you, but you're welcome to follow me in the English if you wish. So the Rambam writes as follows. Babai is Sheni. That's how he opens the story of Hanukkah. Babai is Sheni. We're talking about at the time of the Second Temple. Kashemalche Yavon, and we're talking about when there were Greek rulers under the Greek Empire. And what did they do? Gozru Gezeiros al Yisrael. They persecuted the Jewish people. Ubitlu Dosam. And they suppressed the Jewish religion. Vlohinichu Osom Lasek B'Torah V'Mitzvos. And they didn't allow the Jews to live a life of Torah and Mitzvos. Note, as I said, what I said at the beginning of the Shia, he doesn't say that they threatened the existence of the Jewish people. They weren't out to massacre the Jewish people. They were out to stop them keeping Shabbos, trying to stop them keeping Bris Milah, keeping Kashrus. That's what they wanted to stop. They were out to assimilate the Jewish people into Hellenist culture. And what did they do? Upashti Yodom B'Mamonah B'Bnoseim, right? And they confiscated, they oppressed them financially, and the daughters, in other words, they took Jewish women. V'nichnasu Lahechal U'portu B'Porotzos V'Timu Ataris. And they went into the temple and they desecrated it. Again, notice, they didn't do what the Romans did, right? The Romans and the Babylonians were barbarians. When they hated the Beit HaMikdash, they leveled it, they destroyed it to the ground. They were barbarians. The Greeks weren't barbarians at all. The Greeks were very sophisticated. In fact, the word sophisticated comes from the sophists who were Greek thinkers and Greek writers, right? They were very sophisticated. When they saw a building of great elegance and beauty and aesthetic qualities, the last thing in the world they wanted to do was to destroy it. They didn't destroy anything, right? They wanted to use it for their pagan purposes. So they were metame it. They desecrated it. They didn't destroy it. Are you following me? The Greeks were people who appreciated aesthetics and spirituality. Just they, on the contrary, they accused the Jewish people of being barbaric in certain things, that ke'ilu we were the primitives and they were the sophisticates, particularly Bris Milah, for example. Right? Bris Milah, they consider Bris Milah to be barbaric, to be a mutilation. Right? And from their point of view, the human body was beautiful. The beauty of the human body was something untouchable. Right? For them, see, whereas the Greeks had the barbaric games in the, what's it called, in the arena, yes, the gladiators chopping people up into pieces and blood all over the place and killing, that was Roman entertainment. Because that's entertainment only for barbarians, right? The Greeks had the Olympic Games. They had the Olympic Games. They didn't have any blood and guts and barbaric activities. It was all about sports and the competition and beauty. And it was a different culture completely, right? And in that sense, okay, so what he says here, look at the last three lines on page 1. You can read it in English if you like. But Tzalohem Yisrael ma'od mipneihem. And the Jewish people were in great difficulties because of them. V'lachotzum lachatz gadol, and under great pressure. Acherichem aleihem elokei avoseinu, v'hoshiyom miyodom, until HaKadosh Baruch Hu saved us from this persecution. V'hitzilom, v'govru b'nei hachashmonai kodim gedolim, and the children of the hachashmonai kodim gedolim, they were govru, meaning they were victorious over the Hellenists. V'horgum, and killed the Greeks and drove them out. V'hoshiyu Yisrael miyodom, and they saved the Jewish people from the hands of the persecution of the Greeks. V'hemidu melech min ha'kohanim, and they established a king from among the Kohanim, from their own family of Kohanim. They established a king. V'chozrom malchus liYisrael, and sovereignty returned to the Jewish people. Yeser al mosaim shana ad churban hasheni, for the next 200 years until the destruction of the Second Temple, the Jewish people were sovereign in the land of Israel. What do you hear from the Rambam? The Rambam's giving us a list of the great achievements of the Hashmonaim. They resisted the Hellenists, they engaged them in battle, they were victorious, they got rid of them, and they established a king, Minakarnim. They established Jewish sovereignty. The Rambam lists the establishing of the Malchus as one of their great achievements without any hint at all of any critical view of the Malchus Hashmonaim. Are you following me? The Ramban says what they did was great, but the establishing the Malchus, that was an Avera. The Rambam says, no, the establishment of the Malchus Yisrael was a great achievement. And that was something to be proud of, and that was something wonderful, right? That's all part of the celebrations of Hanukkah, says the Rambam, different to the Rambam, right? So we do have definitely here two schools of thought, hence the title of my talk today, right? Two views on the Hasmonean dynasty, Ramban versus Rambam. There are different schools of thought about whether the establishment of the Malchus Hashmonaim was something to be proud of, or was it an error of judgment, right? And this is something fascinating, which maybe we can spend a little bit of time on. I'd like to go a little bit further. I've got some other sources here, but it's important to understand that this was let's put it this way. Let's ask a question. Let's deal with this Talmudically, right? The Ramban has raised some very important points. Yaakov Avinu said, "Lo yosa shevet mi Yehuda," that the Malchus has to remain with Yehuda, right? And indeed, the Hashmonaim do seem to be acting against that, right? So how does the Rambam answer this question? Are you following me? In other words, let's use the Ramban, if you like, as a foil for the Rambam and ask a question on the Rambam. How can the Rambam list, in his list of great achievements, the establishment of a Jewish dynasty of kings, how can he list that as one of their great achievements if when they did that, they were in violation of such a terrible thing? How can we answer that up? The Rambam must have felt that they establishing the Melech b'Yisrael, not from Yehuda, was justifiable. They must have thought this was justifiable. Why might he have thought that this was justifiable? Anybody got any ideas on this? Why might the Rambam clearly disagrees here with the Rambam. Establishing the kings from the Kohanim and the Hashmonaim was indeed a good idea and a great achievement. Why did he think this was justified? This is the... I can't hear you.
Horacha.
Okay. We can go down that line. Horacha means that sometimes there are exceptions to the rule. Exceptions to the rule. In fact, one of them I mentioned just before, the Torah Shebaal Peh was meant to be only orally transmitted and not written down. And yet Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi decided that the circumstances required it to be written down despite the halacha. But when you say Horasha, you have to give a reason. Why would it be? Why would it be that it was important for them to do this? All right, so it could be. See, in the ancient world, it wasn't a question of electing a new official by vote or anything like that at all. Somebody to be the king had to have power. The king was the head of the government, was head of the military, and only if he was really respected by the military and by the people could he rule, right? So maybe there was nobody in Yehuda who could play that role, whereas the Hashmonaim had proved their mettle, they proved their status, and they were able to do it, and there wasn't anybody else who could do that. Maybe one possibility. There is actually a very interesting, there seems to be in Rashi, there are little indications in Rashi on Tanakh, that Rashi understood that there will be moments when the Kohanim actually are able to get into royal power, right? And one of them is interestingly, I haven't brought to the text here, but it's interesting in Parshas Bezos HaBrocha, where Moshe Rabbeinu is giving brachas to each one of the tribes, and to the Kohanim he says, Baruch Hashem Cheilam, Upal Yodov Yirtzu. In other words, he uses the word chayil, which means military power. He's blessing the Kohanim, Baruch Hashem Chaylam, that their military power should be, the chayalim, right? That military power should be blessed, says Rashi. Military power for the Kohanim, says Rashi in Bezos HaBracha. This is a remez to the Chashmonai. The Moshe Rabbeinu had a sort of a nevuah that there would be a time in the future, at some point, where the Kohanim would rule as kings. So it seems that Rashi also doesn't have the problem that the Ramban has. The Ramban sees this as an avera; it's a transgression to do this. Rashi saw it as something important. There is actually here, mystically, on a mystical level, the Gedolei HaChassidus have got some interesting material on this, which I haven't got time to go into for the moment, but I will share with you one little detail from Rav Tzodok HaKohen of Lublin, one of my favorite Hasidic writers. Rav Tzodok HaKohen from Lublin, I haven't got this on the sheet here. So he says, where did the Kohanim get this from, that they had the right and the ability to become kings? Where did they get malchus from? Right? So he says something very interesting. It's true that the Kohanim were generally not allowed to be kings, but in the genealogy of the Kohanim, there is a little bit of malchus. Where is that? So here's, ladies and gentlemen, a quiz question for you for 5 points. Who was the wife of Aharon HaKohen? Aharon HaKohen in the Chumash marries a woman. And the Pasuk tells us exactly who Aharon HaKohen marries. Not such a well-known detail of the Torah, but Rav Tzodok HaKohen says, you got to pay attention to this detail. Aharon HaKohen mentions, anybody know? Aharon HaKohen marries, right? I can't hear you. Elisheva. Thank you very much. And who was Elisheva? Huh? Vayikach Aaron is Elisheva Achas Achos Nachshon. Right? Ben Aminadov. Nachshon Ben Aminadov was the prince of Yehuda. Are you following me? She was the princess of Yehuda. And she was the mother of all future Kohanim at Sof Kol HaDeiros. She's the wife of Aharon HaKohen, says Rav Tzodok HaKohen. She introduced a little mitzot, a little spark of malchus into the Kohen, which gave them the right at one point in history to become kings, right? That they were able to become kings was in the zechus of Elisheva, right? Elisheva bas Aminodov achos Nachshon, the sister of Nachshon ben Aminodov, a lola isha here till he marries. I think it's a very interesting insight. But of course, the truth is, halachically speaking, the malchus, the status of the king, goes through the male side, not through the female side. But the Sirotoroko, that's true, halachically, but spiritually, she brought that little element of malchus into the Kohanim. The Kohanim had in them a potential of Elisheva bas. So it's a very nice detail in the Hanukkah story, that the Hanukkah story in some way connects to this woman about whom we know very little. But as the wife of Aharon HaKohen, she's clearly a very eminent individual in the Torah, because all future Kohanim in the whole world come from Elisheva, right? Bas Aminodov. So she brings Malchus into the scene, says Tzodok HaKohen, this is an important detail in the Hanukkah story. The Malchus Chashmonaim were a manifestation of the status of Elisheva Bas Aminodov. That's Rav Tzodok HaKohen. I want to share with you for a couple of minutes a very beautiful essay written by Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. I haven't got the text here. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, one of the Gedolim of the previous century. Anybody heard of him or met him? I've met him on a couple of occasions. A very unusual, a very, very special, one of the literature Gedolei Yisrael, a very close friend and colleague of Rav Moshe Feinstein and of Aaron Kotler. They all came from the same Lithuanian background of Talmidei Chachomim, and he was one of the great educators and poskim of the previous generation, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and he writes a Peirush Emes LeYaakov. Emes LeYaakov is a commentary on the Chumash, and in Parshas Vayechi, on this pasuk, Lo Yosor Shevet MiYehuda, he quotes this Ramban, And he says, the Ramban has a criticism of the Chashmonaim, but I want to try and be, if you like, a counsel for the defense, to defend the Chashmonaim. Why did they take the Malchus? So he says something very, very interesting. He says, the return to Israel of the Second Temple period, that everybody knew, or the lead, let's put it this way, the leaders of the Jewish people knew that this was not going to be forever. They knew this was a temporary Malchus. How do we know that? Because we have a lot of literature from Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, all describing Shibas Tzion, the return to Israel. None of them say this is Mashiach. Why don't they say this is the man of Yemos HaMashiach? We know about Mashiach from earlier Nevi'im, from Zechariah, from Yeshayah HaNavi. They all predicted returning to Israel, building the base of Mikdash, and that's the Messianic era, right? And yet the Jews return to Israel, build the base of Mikdash, and nobody says this is the Messianic era. Why not? Why not? Some interesting historical question. Why does no one suggest that this is the Geula? This is the Geula Achrona. Why does nobody suggest that? It says Abraham Kamenetsky, that's clear from the Tanakh, that nobody thought that. But there was always a danger, he says. There was a danger that people might come to think that this is the Geula Achrona. Here we are, that's it. That's what Yeshayah HaNavi predicted. We're back in Israel, we build the base of Mikdash, we have Kohanim, we have Karbonos, we have Yerushalayim. So he says very beautifully, he says that the Chachamim in each generation were very careful to try and remind people, this is not yet the Geula Achrona. We are Baderech, we're on the way, but we're not yet, we haven't reached Geula Achrona. We're not yet in the Messianic era, right? Says Rabbi Yehuda Kamenetsky, if they would have taken a descendant of David HaMelech and put him on the throne at that period, people would have said, that's it. Es tzemach David avdecho, mehera tatzmiach, mekarna torum b'shoazmeke. That's it. It's Yemos HaMashiach. People would have thought that the reestablishment of Malchus based David is a sign that this is the Geula Acharona, and people would have got confused by it. This is Rabbi Yehuda Kamenetsky's genius counsel for the defense of the Chashmonaim against the criticism of the Rambam. Do you understand what's going on here? The Ramban has launched a really bombshell criticism of the Chashmonaim. And so we're going to try and defend them and try and explain why they did what they did. And this Perish of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, I think, is brilliant. And it also goes to explain the Rambam. How come the Rambam is able to list their establishing of the royal dynasty as a great achievement when really it was an Aveira? So we could say with Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, it wasn't an Aveira. It was the right thing to do at the time. It was a Horas Shah justified by this concern. And in fact, the Ramban himself mentions this concern in a few places. He says it's because of that, for example, that the Jewish people in Bais Sheni, they preserved the names of the months, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, which are not of Jewish origin. The Ramban says these came from Persia. They came from Golus. Nisan, right? Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, these are names of Persian deities, right? But they were preserved by Klal Yisrael in Bais Sheni. Why did the Chachamim not say, that's it? I don't want to hear about Nisan anymore and Iyar, right? We're living in Eretz Yisrael. Because they wanted to remind people that we're not yet in the Geula Achrona. We haven't yet achieved the final redemption. Even though living in Israel is a magnificent mitzvah, building the base of Mikdash is a magnificent mitzvah, having Kohanim and Levim and Karbonos, all this is fantastic. It's fantastic and a great achievement. But if they would have had a king of Malchus based David, that would have confused people. And that's why they didn't want it. And that's from Yaakov Kamenetsky, which I think is very, very beautiful. Yes, okay, so you're asking a good question. That's a good question. I think the question was, what is the purpose of reminding people all the time this is not the Gula Akhrana? Why not tell them, make it into the Gula Akhrana? Is that your question? They must have understood that it was much too early in Jewish history for the Gula Akhrana to take place. Now, the Gula Akhrana, what Yeshaya HaNavi was predicting, was, don't forget, the prediction of the Messianic time is a prediction when all the nations of the world come to a new spiritual understanding of morality and of belief and understanding, right? And they realized they were light years away from that, that was not possible. Right, and that right, the our image of Yemosa Mashiach is v'yeda kol pol k'ata pa'alto v'yobin kol yotzur k'ata yitzarto. Right, that all the nations of the world will recognize ki mitzion teitzei Torah u'dvar Hashem Yerushalayim. That pasuk that we're so familiar with, ki mitzion, is Yeshaya speaking about messianic times. All the nations of the world will say together, that the word of God only comes from Yerushalayim. They must have realized that was something which was still so distant that it's not possible for us yet to deal with that. But nevertheless, and this is an important point, also in modern times, living in Israel and the Kedusha of Israel and the Kedusha of Yerushalayim and identifying with the land of Israel and the people of Israel is a massively valuable achievement, even if it's not messianic. Listen to that. I've mentioned this before in earlier shiurim. Was a great debate 100 years ago between Rav Kook and Rabbi Rinus. Is modern religious Zionism, does it have to be messianic or not messianic? Rav Kook actually made modern religious Zionism very messianic. It was all about we are bringing the Geula. But Rav Rinus at the time had a very powerful, who was the founder of the Mizrahi movement, and it was a very influential writer at the time. He said, no, let's not talk about Mashiach. Let's just talk about Eretz Yisrael as the Eretz Ha'avot, the Eretz HaKodesh, the mitzvahs of Eretz Yisrael, the beauty of Eretz Yisrael. Whether Mashiach comes or not, that's not our business. We're not here bringing Mashiach. We're here getting closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're here keeping mitzvahs and getting closer to Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. So that is a bigger debate, right? But I think your point is a good point, and I haven't got time to deal with it completely now, but definitely the at the time, not bringing the Malchus Yisrael back to David HaMelech, says Rabbi Kamenetsky, was done in a very thoughtful way to prevent confusing. So the Jewish people shouldn't get confused and think that the Mashiach has come. Don't forget, throughout Jewish history, without exception, every time somebody thought Mashiach was here, it was a disaster, right? The whole idea of all the false messiahs we've had over Jewish history, people who've claimed to be Mashiach, the Shabtai Tzvi's of this world, it's always been an unmitigated disaster. So he was worried that if anybody from Malchus Beis David would sit on the throne, they would say, right, he's Mashiach. This is it, Mashiach has arrived. And this is a very confusing idea. The time will come, Mashiach will come, and we'll all know about it, right? But we're not there yet, we're not there yet. Okay, it's already 12:30, I think we have to stop here, but I hope I've given you a little bit of an additional insight into a deeper understanding of the importance of the Chashmonaim, the achievements of the Chashmonaim, and by the way, the involvement of Elisheva Bas Aminodov Achaz Nachshon, that she planted in the neshama of all future Kohanim the potential for Malchus, for leadership of the nation. That's it for today. I wish you all a Chanukah Sameach. And don't forget to eat as many donuts and latkes as you possibly can, because that's a wonderful mitzvah, and it's all calorie-free on Hanukkah. You don't have to worry about anything at all. That is the mitzvah of Hanukkah. Enjoy Hanukkah with your families. Please God, next week we'll continue.